Good afternoon and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. We are now ready to begin our final argument for our September 13th calendar. Thank you to both counsel for making a quick switch. We are holding this argument via the Zoom platform, and we're sorry that we didn't get to see you in person this time. Hopefully we can the next time around, and we appreciate your flexibility today. The case before us is A220444, Booker Timothy Hodges, petitioner, appellant versus State of Minnesota, respondent. I am joined by my colleagues. Did we just lose one of our attorneys? We did. We're just going to take a pause so we can get Mr. Wald back. Mr. Wald, can you hear us? Booker Timothy Hodges versus the State of Minnesota. And counsel, you will each have 15 minutes for your argument. Counsel for the appellant will have 5 minutes. Can you both see the clock on the screen that's keeping track of your time?
Yes.
Okay, great. We are making a recording of the arguments this morning that will be available on the court's website a little later. When you're not speaking, please just make sure that you have your mute button on. And that concludes my remarks. We're now ready to hear for counsel for the appellant. Mr. Longstorff, you may proceed.
Thank you. My name is Zach Longstorff. I represent appellant Booker Hodges. The reason that this is not a petition for post-conviction relief, and unlike the Coles and Evans cases cited by the prosecution or the Lewis case that's discussed in Coles, is that this is a truly unauthorized sentence in that it is facially invalid because it violates one of the few absolutes in sentencing, which is that the only true upper limit on the length of a sentence the district court can impose is the statutory maximum sentence as set by the legislature.
Mr. Longstorff, there was a plea agreement in this case, and this is where I'm stuck with your argument and can't get beyond what you're asserting, because he had the ability to have a charge that would not be affecting him. I mean, this makes no sense at all that it wouldn't be treated as a petition for post-conviction relief when it affects the negotiations that went on. I mean, how do you respond to that?
The distinction, I think, Your Honor, between this case and those other cases is that, for example, in the Coles case, the defendant had a sentence of 96 months, and that was a departure. And in the Lewis case, the defendant got a sentence of 86 months stayed, which was a departure. But in each of those cases, the sentence the defendant received was within the statutory maximum for the offense. And so what those cases like Coles and Evans and Lewis talk about is that a defendant can't get out of the departure in those cases because doing so takes a benefit from the state. And the difference is, in this case, that a sentence over the statutory maximum is not a benefit that the state was ever entitled to have.
Can I just ask one question or concern that I have? Is just simply the language of 609-3455. And he was sentenced under subdivision 4, right? I mean, that was the provision that provided the life sentence that was in play here. Am I right about that?
Yes.
So the 2006 version of that statute says, notwithstanding the statutory maximum penalty otherwise applicable to the offense, doesn't that disclaimer take away the constraint of the statutory maximum sentence, regardless of, you know, what the negotiation was in the sentence. And, you know, that subdivision 4 does reference the third degree statute that he was ultimately convicted under. So why doesn't that language take care of the problem you've identified?
I don't think that it takes care of the problem we've identified, because the subsection 4 creates the life sentence, and then subsection 5 dictates how to put in place the mandatory minimum term of imprisonment that needs to be served. And when the Supreme Court was deciding in Hodges 2 how that these sentences should be imposed, they were saying that when you do the mandatory minimum term, you do it as if there was no life sentence. So in our view, having that first sentence of subdivision 4 do away with the mandatory or the statutory maximum for all purposes actually undermines the holding in Hodges 2, which says that you should figure out the mandatory minimum term as if there is no life sentence. And really, if in fact that provision is meant to undo the statutory maximum for all of these offenses, I think that what has happened is that there is a situation created where there's 6 offenses listed in 609.3455 subdivision 4. We've got first through fourth degree criminal sexual conduct, then criminal sexual predatory conduct, and sexual extortion. If that first sentence undoes the statutory maximum for all 6 of those offenses, then it's created a scenario where a defendant could be charged with first through fourth degree criminal sexual conduct, be acquitted of first through third degree, be convicted of fourth degree, and still get a sentence of life with a mandatory minimum term of life, or 300 months, or life with 180 months, which are all sentences that would otherwise only be available for first, second, or third degree convictions. And so if that's what that statute actually does, then 609.3455 has effectively eliminated all distinctions between first through fourth degree criminal sexual conduct as far as sentencing goes. And I don't think that that's what the statute is meant to do, or what the Supreme Court held implicitly or otherwise in Hodges 2, because it would take away all the guideposts for a sentencing a defendant. And I think if we take it to the logical conclusion that the Supreme Court noted in Hodges 2, that it probably requires the imposition of life with life for all 6 of those offenses. I also think that implicitly eliminating all distinction between the sentences that can be imposed for those offenses is a strange thing to do when the explicit statutory maximum for those offenses varies so much. You can get life on a first degree, up to 300 for a second degree. It goes down to 180 for third degree and 120 months for fourth degree. But in practical impact, if the statutory maximum is overridden for all purposes, then any single one of those 6 offenses listed in 0.3455 subdivision 4 can be sentenced with the sentence of up to life with a mandatory minimum term of life. And I think that that contradicts both how the Supreme Court said to determine the statutory maximums in Hodges, the mandatory minimum terms in Hodges 2, and has the practical impact of removing all the upper limits on sentencing for those offenses. Now, going
so
back
another little, another question. I know that you, of course, are contesting the fact that this was actually a post-conviction petition, that that this was a straight up, you know, motion for correction of sentence, and the argument that I think you're making, but I just want to make sure that I'm understanding it, is that it necessarily has to be construed as a motion for correction of sentence, regardless of whether there was a plea negotiation involved, because the sentence he got was illegal and an individual can't agree to an illegal sentence. Is that essentially the argument that you're making?
I do think that that's part of it, Your Honor, that regardless of what a defendant and the state agree, if there is a sentence that exceeds a statutory maximum, that's something that's outside the district court's discretion to even impose. And I think that that's really what does set this apart from other cases involving a plea where there's charges dropped and where there's some kind of departure, is in all those other cases that I've seen, which are like Coles, Evans, in Lewis, you see a scenario where what is being contested is a sentence which is inside the statutory maximum. And I think in this case, that the sentence up to 180 months, regardless of whether it's a departure, is perfectly acceptable. And that's not something that Hodges has challenged. He's just saying that this 60 months, it's over the statutory maximum, is not something that the state had a benefit or a legitimate interest in obtaining in the first place. And therefore, if in fact his sentence is brought back in line with the statutory maximum, which is 180 months, that the state doesn't lose anything that it legitimately had under in the beginning. And so that this is not a scenario like Coles or Lewis or Evans, where the state is actually losing something that it could actually have. And I would also note,
what are we to make of the fact that the Supreme Court has already spoken on the sentence? The Supreme Court may not have considered the issue that you've brought forth in your motion, but the Supreme Court has, you know, expressly concluded that the sentence here was lawful. What are we as the error-correcting court to do with that?
Well, I don't think that the Supreme Court actually decided this particular issue. I don't think there was anything in the record of this case from the district court, the briefs to this court, or from the Supreme Court in Mr. Hodges' direct appeal that gives any indication that this was an issue that was considered or decided by any court. And what we were dealing with at the time was a brand new statute that Mr. Hodges was essentially the case of first impression for. And I don't think there's anything to indicate that anybody ever considered this issue. And so Mr. Hodges doesn't agree with the idea that the Supreme Court did implicitly conclude that the statutory maximum had been overridden for all purposes. And the other thing,
the Supreme Court didn't have this specific issue before it. I mean, wasn't it the responsibility of counsel to raise the issue to the Supreme Court?
I do believe that Mr. Hodges' attorney in his direct appeal should have raised the issue to the court. But part of the issue with that, I think, is that this was truly an issue of first impression. And I don't think anybody truly understood how this statute was going to work with the statutory maximum and the mandatory minimum terms as given. You can see that the district court took a couple different tacks about how it's going to justify the 240 months that were imposed. And I think that saying that the Supreme Court, I mean, it did approve the sentence and it did say that, you know, 240 months was an appropriate sentence, but I don't think it ever decided this issue. It was never raised before that court, and there isn't anything to indicate that it actually concluded that it would be appropriate for the statutory maximum to be overridden. And I do think that, you know, sort of reading that into the Supreme Court opinion is actually a little problematic, because it does, I believe, and Mr. Hodges believes, that implicit holding that the statutory maximum is actually overridden for all purposes actually contradicts the actual holding, the direct holding of Hodges 2. And that says that first the district court puts in place the life sentence, and then from there it figures out what the mandatory minimum term is going to be as if there was no life sentence. And so I think that it actually does contradict the actual holding of Hodges 2, if that's what we believe that the Supreme Court implicitly decided. And so I don't think that there was actually anything that the Supreme Court decided that would preclude a lower court from saying, hey, this issue wasn't decided, I'm going to decide it. And we have, in fact, here a situation where we have a mandatory minimum term that exceeds the statutory maximum for that defendant's offense. And aside from the idea that the Supreme Court had implicitly concluded that the statutory maximum is overridden, there isn't really any justification for such a sentence, since truly, when we look at, you know, cases about departures, we see that really the only upper limit on a district court's discretion to impose a sentence is the statutory maximum put in place by the legislature. So I don't think, one, it's not an issue that was decided. And because of the way it was raised, I don't think that any lower court would be precluded from determining that this issue, precluded from deciding this issue. And I would note that there's the Waymire case, which is cited in Mr. Hodge's materials. And that's a case that actually relies a lot on Mr. Hodge's case, Hodge's 2, for the district court, for the courts to figure out what exactly this individual's sentence should be. And in that case, the court concluded that it was improper for the mandatory minimum term to exceed the statutory maximum and reversed and remanded for an imposition of a mandatory minimum term that didn't exceed the statutory maximum. And I think that would be the appropriate remedy here in Mr. Hodge's case would be a remand for that. And so what we have here is a sentence that's unauthorized in really the clearest sense of that term. It's a mandatory minimum term that exceeds the statutory maximum for the offense that Mr. Hodges pled guilty to by 60 months. The idea that the law of the case or there's an implicit confirmation by the Supreme Court that the statutory maximum is overridden doesn't really hold up because the implicit holding then directly contradicts the actual holding of Hodges too. And I think that it then creates a scenario where any of the six offenses listed in 609.3455 subdivision 4 could be sentenced with a sentence of up to life with a mandatory minimum term of life. And I don't think that that's what the statute meant or that's what the Supreme Court meant to do. In Rule 27.03 subdivision 9, we've got a rule that allows for the correction of an unauthorized sentence at any time. This is an appropriate case to take that at face value and apply it to Mr. Hodges and grant relief. Thank you.
Thank you for your argument. And next we will turn to counsel for respondent. You may proceed, Mr. Wald.
Thank you. May I please the court? My name is Jeffrey Wald, and I represent respondent state of Minnesota in this appeal. Appellant's claim that his 240-month minimum term of imprisonment is unauthorized by law and should be reduced to 180 months can easily be rejected by this court for three reasons. First, and perhaps most importantly, his claim is clearly barred by the law of the case doctrine, because in 2013, in Hodges 3, this court heard and rejected the very argument that appellant now raises. And under Minnesota Rule of Civil Appellate Procedure 136.01 Subdivision 1C, this court's non-precedential decision in Hodges 3 remains binding authority as law of the case. Second, because his claim attacks more than his sentence, it is properly treated as a post-conviction claim and is time barred. Third, his claim is NAFLA barred, because he either raised this claim or could have raised it in his three previous challenges to his sentence. Because appellant's claim is precluded by three distinct procedural bars, the state respectfully requests that this court affirm Judge Gruing's order denying relief. And if there are no questions, I just want to emphasize in response to appellant's argument, that the state's primary argument is not that Hodges 2, the Minnesota Supreme Court decision, is what is law of the case in precluding appellant's claim. It is this court's decision in 2013, which directly addressed this very claim and said, basically, it's law of the case. And appellant is free to petition for review. And if the Minnesota Supreme Court wants to revisit appellant's sentence, it will be free to accept review and do so. So if there are no questions, I would simply ask that this court affirm Judge Gruing's order denying relief. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Wald. Mr. Longstorff, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal. We will, there's the clock. You may proceed if you care to give any rebuttal argument.
Thank you. I just want to briefly address the idea that NAFLA would apply in this scenario to deny Mr. Hodges the opportunity for relief. I don't think that the Minnesota Supreme Court has ever decided whether NAFLA applies to a Rule 27.03 Subdivision 9 motion. On the other hand, this court has, and it was State v. Amundson, where this court held that it does not. In Mr. Hodge's view, applying NAFLA would contradict the plain language of Rule 27.03, Subdivision 9, which again says that an unauthorized sentence can be corrected at any time and would conflict with this court's ruling in Amundson. As far as the law of the case precluding review, I would just note that the law of the case, which is that this court determined that the Supreme Court implicitly held that the statutory maximum was overridden for all purposes, truly does conflict with the actual holding of Hodges 2. And I don't think there would be anything that would preclude a panel of this court from recognizing that fact, concluding that Mr. Hodges has a sentence which exceeds the statutory maximum for his offense in the mandatory minimum term, and recognizing that Hodges is the only person who's got that particular sentence, recognizing that the sentencing guidelines actually have notations based on this case to prevent this kind of thing, and granting Mr. Hodges relief. Absent any questions, I have nothing further.
Thank you both for your arguments this morning. The case is now submitted to us.